Okay, the title of my paper is The North Polar Expeditions of Robert E. Peary, Matthew Henson, and Frederick Cook, A Semiology of American Nationalist and Masculinist Discourses. On the board. The North Pole is represented as a much sought-after goal of U.S. national significance at the beginning of the 20th century. I am interested in the cultural representations of American North Polar explorations and in how concrete social meanings have been given to this abstract space, the North Pole, at this specific historical moment. My interest specifically is to connect the mythical schema of the North Pole to different male cultural identities of the U.S. Early North Polar expeditions, which began in the late 15th century, were searches by European nations for shorter commercial ship routes from the Atlantic to the Pacific by way of the Arctic Ocean. The British led the search for the Northwest Passage around the Canadian archipelago, while the Dutch searched for the Northeast Passage around the northern coast of Russia. Attempts to find a Northwest Passage were made by British explorers such as Sir Francis Drake, Sir Martin Frobisher, in 1607 Henry Hudson, in 1778 Captain James Cook, 1829 Sir John Ross, and in 1845 Sir John Franklin. Among the Dutch explorers searching for the Northeast Passage were William Barents in 1594, William Baffin, and in 1822, William Scoresby Jr. It was not until 1878 that the Northeast Passage was first traversed by Baron Bordenskjold, a Swedish explorer. The Norwegian Raoul Amundsen was the first to sail through the Northwest Passage in 1906. Although the site of the North Pole itself excited fascination and curiosity, the search for the North Pole as a goal in its own right did not occur until the first half of the 19th century. While the search for the Northwest and Northeast passages was rooted in commercial motives, the struggle to reach the North Pole was fueled in large part by national pride. There was a rivalry amongst nations to attain this purely symbolic objective. The interest in the North Pole as an institutionalized activity that generated its own discourse began when the British Parliament offered a reward for the first person to reach the pole in 1827. After 1827, there were many attempts to reach the pole by men of different nations. The British explorer Parry was the first of many to try for the pole. Since the North Pole was inaccessible by boat, as it was located on the polar ice, new means of transportation were sought in order to reach it. Parry had tried to reach the pole using sledges pulled by reindeer in 1829. In 1897, a Scandinavian group of three men attempted to reach the North Pole by balloon. Both expeditions were unsuccessful, and all the members in the balloon expedition died. For the purposes of this presentation, I will focus on the two American expeditions of Robert Peary and Frederick Cook. Henson was a black American explorer on the Peary expedition. Although both parties, Peary and Cook's, claimed to have discovered the North Pole, only Robert Peary's 1909 expedition was given credit as the official discovery. Peary, an American naval officer, had the support of Theodore Roosevelt, the president of the U.S. at that time. And if we can maybe have the slide. There they are. Is it focused? Okay. As well as the leading geographical, political, economical, and cultural institutions. The claim of the 1908 expedition led by an American physician, Dr. Frederick Cook, had been officially discredited. The controversy over Cook and Peary's claim still persists, although widespread public support for Cook's claim disappeared around World War I. Both Peary and Cook's claims were revealed as hoaxes in the 1960s. It was argued that neither of them made it near the pole. Recently, there has been even a renewed interest concerning the veracity of each of their claims. The turn of the 20th century was a period of anxiety for the U.S. As an ex-British colony, the U.S. wanted to establish a place for itself amongst the other world powers. Its desire to compete with Europe's empire-building activities reached a climax in 1898 with its success in the Spanish-American War. The fledgling U.S. empire's boundaries were extended to include new territories, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the Philippines. The U.S.'s interest in obtaining the North Pole so shortly afterwards could be seen as a projection of its imperialist enterprise into an extraterrestrial space. Located literally on the boundaries of the world, the conquest of the North Pole was thought of as a pointed symbol of the U.S.'s growing strength. To define and literally mark the periphery of the world would be a suitable way to reveal the control befitting a nation that aspired to be at the center. The desire for this aspiring world power to touch a literal mathematical point without length, breadth, or thickness, to make visible a space that was sealed off from the scrutiny of a perceiving subject, to feel a space of floating ice, an empty space, a dead space, to penetrate a virgin space, which was already full, where nothing could be added and nothing could be stained, to define a space without reference or shape, to make real the unreal, to give life to what was barren, to offer a true language to deal with a void, to prove virility by penetrating the abstract. This masculinist desire and nationalist drive is located in the register of the imaginary. The North Pole became a fitting symbol of American imperialist intentions and growing world power precisely because it represented the imaginary of a whole culture. I am interested in using the North Pole as an example that will allow me to come to terms with the symbolic in relation to the imaginary. To do this, I will examine how the discourse of the North Pole is projected into the symbolic field. The North Pole can only be socially constructed, as it isn't a tangible object. It is not surprising that the popular representations of the conquest of the pole were usually not images of the pole itself, but maps or charts of the polar explorer's route. Although as a site, the North Pole was the very embodiment of the inauthentic, the unreal. In its representation, it became transformed into an image of stability, wholeness, and permanence. Before its discovery, it was fantasized in one illustration as being made out of topaz or diamond. In this one, it is in the shape of a pyramid or phallus. After its discovery, it was represented as a fixed point of world significance. Representations of the pole literally substituted the North Pole for a raw mineral to be discovered and then produced by capital. One representation, which typically transformed the North Pole into an image of an American commodity, shows the American flag hoisted at the pole with the caption, part of the caption, the stars and stripes planted upon the axis of the world. It's from the axis of the world that the earth moves. The axis of the world, an actual mathematical point, becomes an object that can not only be discovered, but represented with the national tag, an American flag. With the additional phrase, the goal of 1,000 years, the event of the discovery becomes the capitalist version of the quest. The object of desire is non-material, has eluded capture for 1,000 years. Once captured, the North Pole becomes a symbol that the market system has permeated the world. Even places where there is no land can be charted and marketed. A mathematical point can be ingeniously be packaged into a national symbol. The representation of the North Pole as a much sought-after goal of U.S. national significance also provided an occasion to represent the male hero, also a cultural construct, as centered and whole. Thus, portraits of the dauntless explorers here are superimposed over the image of a map. Male rivalry is implied, not explicit, but as part of the requisite struggle for the desired metaphorical overview needed for world domination. Yet, while the male hero explorer is represented in the popular media as centered and whole, it is only at the level of form and ideology that this figure is in control of his experience. The autobiographical accounts of the polar explorers seem to reveal another story. I will examine how Perry, Cook, and Henson describe the lived truth of their experience. I am interested in analyzing how the three explorers, expressed through language the tension of an experience in which mastery depended on sighting an object that could not be seen. The accounts I'm using are taken from Cook, Perry, and Henson's published autobiographies. Cook's My Attainment of the Pole was published in 1913, Perry's The North Pole in 1910, and Henson's A Negro Explorer at the North Pole in 1911. I'm going to show you pictures of these explorers. This is Perry afterwards. A little worn out. Henson, the black American that joined his expedition. And Cook. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'll put on Perry while I talk, right? The worn-out explorer. Okay. Both these accounts, all three of these accounts are stories, okay, the accounts of these three men, about entry into a privileged mythical space that turns out to be also physically dangerous, and then emergence from it. For Cook and Perry, the pole is not the dark place. There is tremendous glare. It is all exterior, but you need to shield your eyes from it. Perry writes about how he has been, quote, subjected to brilliant and unremitting daylight for days and weeks, close quote. Cook takes refuge in the imagination and transforms the monotony of the never-ending day of the polar region into a poetic vision. For him, the pole is a burning orange world floored with a sparkling sheen of millions of diamonds, close quote. There is too much awareness by these men that they have risked their lives to act out an illusory spectacle. Their embarrassment at finding themselves as real actors in a deadly fiction can be read between the lines. This is more than just disappointment or surprise in finding literally nothing visibly different about this privileged spot. Once found, the anticipatory value of its discovery is lost. For Cook, the pole, after its discovery, was merely a dead world of ice that he preferred to turn his back on. In Cook's account, there is the difficulty of finding a common denominator in which he can negotiate the neutral and impersonal quality of his surroundings with any personal experience of conquest. Quote, the depressing monotony of scene and its lack of any spiritual pleasure only expresses for him his steady drag of chronic fatigue. Rather than offering any form of relief, a further scrutiny of the horizon reflects a sense of intense loneliness. In both Cook and Perry's descriptions, the props of discovery and conquest, the compass, the telescope, the flag, and the camera, take on a hyper-real significance. The compass is the one thing that is, quote, as useful as ever for Cook. In his description, it becomes the only indication of life for his group, who themselves are just barely alive, pulsating creatures in a dead world of ice. Cook's own identification with his compass enables him to imagine a sense of euphoria in which he imagines himself for a brief moment outside his own experience of extreme sensory deprivation. Quote, north, east, and west had vanished. It was south in every direction. With a step, it was possible to go from one part of the globe to the opposite side. Perry's euphoria, instead, is about his ability to transcend his dependence on his instruments. He uses his instruments, but triumphs over them because he can choose his experience. He uses his instruments selectively to achieve the control he wants. They can be used to, quote, verify his position at the summit of the world. Yet, when his instruments tell him that he is traveling north towards the pole, and then south when he passes the pole, and Perry knows that he was always traveling in the same direction, despite what his instruments indicate, Perry can claim to master two kinds of experiences. But only to a point. For Perry and Cook, the North Pole is perceivable only through scientific instruments. Nothing can be observed. The redundancy of the eye with the sighting of the pole can only be technological, not personal. Hence, in Cook's account, the phrase scientific observation means calculation, the very opposite of observations. Quote, on April 21, the first corrected altitude of the sun gave 89 degrees, 59 minutes, 46 seconds. The pole was therefore in sight. We advanced 14 seconds, made supplementary observations, and prepared to stay long enough to permit a double round of observations. By personalizing the impersonal, mine at last, Perry is desperately trying to hold on to his status as hero and thus claim something he cannot see or feel. His image of his being in these exclusive regions which no mortal has ever penetrated before seems incongruous with his actual activity of, quote, taking photographs, planting the flags, studying the horizon with his telescope for possible land, and searching for a place to make a sounding. No wonder, quote, his dream and goal for 20 years all seemed so simple and commonplace once he reached the site itself. Cook's arrival on the spot unveils the myth that motivated his efforts. He writes, quote, after spending 2 days at the pole, the glamour wore away. I can get no sensation of novelty. Hungry, mentally and physically exhausted, a sense of the utter uselessness of this thing, of the empty reward of my endurance, followed my exhilaration. During these last hours, I asked myself why this place had so aroused an enthusiasm long-lasting though through self-sacrificing years. Why for so many centuries men had sought this elusive spot? What a futile thing I thought to die for. Cook realizes his part in what he now calls a, quote, travesty, an ironic satire, his vainglorious human aspiration and endeavor. From his earlier image of the pole, which was one of splendor and plentitude, his new image of it is that of a, quote, vacant, silver-shining goal of death. Both Perry and Cook's selfhood is threatened by the tools of science. They need science to enter into this cold and dangerous place, yet science proves to be an ambiguous ally. Science threatens to emasculate man, yet it is a useful tool to lift the veil of nature. In a different way, nature too can destroy the personalization of the subject. Cook describes himself and his companions merely as, quote, the only pulsating creatures in a dead world of ice. As Cook gets closer and closer, he risks insanity and death, he has hallucinations, as he is cut off from the comprehension of his surroundings and his own senses. Male desire is aroused by this elusive spot that turns out to be vacant, a silver shining goal of death. Matthew Henson, the black American man who accompanies Perry to the pole, wrote about his experience there. Unlike Perry and Cook, his euphoria is not in relation to the instruments. As he is denied access to the tools of science, Henson does not know when he has reached the pole. He has to wait until Perry tells him. It's the racist discourse. Perry relies on Henson's intuitive sense of gauging distances for most of the trip, yet when they reach the pole, Henson is reliant on Perry. The instruments take on a subject position in Henson's narrative. They are an extension of Perry. Henson, as Perry's body servant, protects the instruments as he would watch over Perry's life. The instruments are given more value than Henson's life. Henson is denied sharing in Perry's discovery of the pole until afterwards, when there is a collective sharing around the flag-raising ceremony. Let's see. Henson's euphoria is reserved for the celebration of American nationalism. His participation along with the Eskimos is the signal that this discovery is for the purposes of American democracy. Yet, in the celebration of democracy, there are still some absent subjects. Perry and Cook's expeditions exclude the presence of women. Perry's wife, Josephine Diebitsch Perry, who accompanied Perry on all of his other expeditions, was also an explorer in her own right. She published in 1893 her autobiography called Arctic Journal, A Year Among the Ice Fields and Eskimos. Although Josephine Diebitsch Perry was not physically present, she is evoked by Perry in his autobiography. She is the seamstress of the American flag that Perry plants at the pole. She is the wife and mother that Perry writes a message to when he reaches the pole. There are other absences, other missing seamstresses. Perry and Henson's Eskimo mistresses and the Eskimo women that made the clothing for the expedition are also repressed from this American celebration of democracy. While the Eskimo mistresses have disappeared from history, with the exception of the photograph of Perry's mistress in his text, Northwest Over the Great Ice, their sons have not been erased. In the 1980s, there is a new phase of reconstruction of the North Pole myth. In 1986, a black American male scholar from Harvard, Dr. Alan Counter, traveled to the northwest part of Greenland to discover the male offspring of Perry and Henson. Counter intends to bring the Perry and Henson clan back to the United States. I guess now we have 35 minutes for questions.